doesn't it have that quality that I just want to like truncate it and say, well, yeah, I guess it's big. Is it bold? I guess it's bold. Is it beautiful? Yeah, and sometimes it is. Is it a journey? Oh boy, is it. So I just think it's kind of shameless that way. And I think it'll be quickly forgotten, really, because it's not a film that has gotten good reviews or done well. And it's a misfire.
Hello, and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about One Battle After Another and One, A Big, Bold, Beautiful Journey. I always get that, such a confusing title. But let's start off with the One Battle After Another. Mike, I know you're going to have so much to say about this Paul Thomas Anderson movie. So set the stage.
Yeah, let's do battle. We'll enter into it immediately. Paul Thomas Anderson is such an ambitious, really audacious filmmaker that I always want to see whatever he makes. And he's made a lot of films. When you think about films like There Will Be Blood, The Master, on and on, oftentimes, you know, sprawling ensemble pieces. Some of his earlier films, you know, you think about Robert Altman that way. But the person to think about here actually is the novelist Thomas Pynchon. This is the second film that Anderson's made that's loosely inspired by a Pynchon novel. The other one would be Inherent Vice from 2014. And I got to say, the reason I want to do battle is this. The film we're talking about, One Battle After Another, as you and I speak in the fall of 25, it's among the best reviewed films of the year. I mean, people are really throwing out the superlatives. And I want to offer a bit of a minority report. I mean, there's much to admire here. There are definite strengths here for sure. And it's like better than 90% of the films I see. So all that duly acknowledged. But for me, and I know I have over running times, but this film has a running time of 2 hours and 41 minutes. And for my money, it wears thin after a while. And I think that's actually, frankly, a problem sometimes with Pynchon's novels. I mean, you know, a great novelist, and yet, you know, you have the heft of the book sometimes. And another thing, this gets into like quasi-philosophical ground. Without spoiling anything in this film, there are many scenes and indeed a few characters who I would say are borderline implausible. And, you know, it's like really far-fetched satire. And at what point subjectively do you as a viewer say, oh, come on now, like he wouldn't do that or she wouldn't be that way or whatever the case might be there. And again, that is very individualized as to how do you respond to that. But in the aggregate, I think it ultimately hurts the film. And the quasi-philosophical aspect, though, is this. In a Pynchon novel, there are things that when I see them on the page, I might laugh or I might scoff or I might whatever, but somehow my imagination says, oh, okay, let's go with it, you know, and I'll go with it. The nature of film, of course, is that sort of literal mindedness in a visual sense that you're actually seeing it there. And for me, it's sometimes like more difficult to accept it when I see it on screen than if I were, we'll talk about Sean Penn's character in a while, but there are things that I think, oh, come on now. But just to set the stage as you want me to do in a concise way, which I've never done before, but in a concise way to set the stage here, there's a character, Bob Ferguson, played by Leonardo DiCaprio. And I got to say at the outset, this is a superbly acted film. I mean, it's really, really impressively cast and acted. So whatever my reservations, boy, all kudos to the actors who will get Academy Award nominations, I'm sure. He plays a foolish revolutionary. And what's interesting here is that for the length of the film, it doesn't really go into details. You're not going to get the names of politicians. You're not going to get specific agenda items. These are revolutionaries who are calling for freedom. Well, we all want freedom, but they are violent and among themselves as much as against the government and so on. There are some scenes like a detention center for immigrants somewhere. How can you not connect the dots between our headlines and what's going on in the film. And indeed, you know, the Pynchon novel, which came out in Vineland, which came out in 1990, is very much set in the 1980s, but looking back to the 1960s. So what I think Anderson does very cleverly here is it's very much a film in our own time. And yet our protagonist, if we can call him that, I guess, is constantly flashing back to things from 16 years earlier. So you go back to the period when he was an active revolutionary. Since then, he's literally gone to pot. He smokes, he drinks, he's a mess. And DiCaprio really lets himself be a mess in this. And he lives in the perfect place for this kind of recluse, Northern California, among the redwoods. You know, he's sort of hiding out in the woods. And so it's a really intriguing character study in that respect. And so the organization he had belonged to was called French 75. And this is a movie. It's full of references. French 75 was a field gun. It was also the name of a cocktail in Casablanca. So So, you know, I mean, this is just chock full of things you can talk about for hours. But anyway, it was one of those sort of Antifa type groups going back in the day in this case. And sometimes groups like that are not, however well organized they might or might not be, sometimes their ideological agenda can be confused, can be kind of a model. And so maybe the film is realistic in that respect. In any event, the film's going to jump back and forth in various ways from what he was doing 16 years earlier to now, when he's still very much on the run and hiding and sort of out of commission, or wants to be out of commission. The one thing I like so much about the film actually is that even the parts of it to me seemed to have sort of a tenuous grasp of character and motivation and blah, 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 what comes through very strongly is that for all of his failures and for all of his lassitude at this point, just hanging out like that, he's a devoted dad. And the relationship between Bob, that character, and Bob's been known by various names throughout his history, but the relationship between Bob and his daughter, Willa, is really quite moving, actually. I wish the film had more of that, just in general, to keep it anchored or somehow tethered to a reality I can relate to. Because some of the rest of it is so violent and so extreme and so relentless that I might laugh at times, but after a while, honestly, I was just thinking, enough already. So enough already, back to you.
Okay. Well, I had kind of the same reaction you did. I went in really wanting to like it because I like this director. And, you know, the interesting thing about him is I think everybody thinks he makes great movies, but they're not movies that make a lot of money. But this time he's got Leonardo DiCaprio and Sean Penn. So I think, you know, this might be the one that actually breaks him. He might be the breakout film that introduces him to a wider audience. The two main guys, Leonardo DiCaprio and Sean Penn, are both incredible in this. They both are kind of falling apart, but in completely different ways. Leonardo DiCaprio is just sort of, he's letting it all hang out. It's all just exploding out of him. And he spends most of the movie, you know, with dirty hair and wearing a bathrobe. He looks terrible, but he owns it. Whereas Sean Penn is just this locked down. Everything that is shattering in him, he is just holding as tightly as he can. He has the most interesting walk. You just see everything he is struggling with, just even in the way he walks. I'm going to say this will be nominated for Best Picture, and he will probably pick up another Academy Award as Best Supporting Actor. He was the best part of the movie, and he's the bad guy.
It's going to receive nominations in all the major categories. That's a lock. When you talk about the lockdown quality of the character, he has a great name, Colonel Stephen J. Lockjaw. And so that's his character. In terms of how he walks, Sean Penn is really, really smart with how he handles the physicality of the character. And one of the reviews of the film said it seems like he has like a rod, you know, stuck up his posterior, I'll put it politely. But he sort of walks that way. And there are scenes where you're meant to think that, because he's walking down the road, let's say, and you find yourself, you know, almost like in a silent film, you're watching the body language of him, and it's a totally controlled performance. And Sean Penn's obviously done a lot of really good work, but this is one of his best performances. However I might feel about the character, and sometimes the character is so extreme there that he almost seems like the Jack D. Ripper character in Stanley Kubrick's film. I mean, don't you sometimes feel that way, that it's just like this, like really, really extreme, you know, beyond realism into a sort of hyper reality that way? And so, you know, it really reminds me of what Kubrick did, and just the naming of the character. Now, the naming of the character is the sort of thing that you expect from Pynchon, to this sort of silly, quasi-silly names. But the Kubrick connection, when you think of Dr. Strangelove, it really in some ways reminds me of Dr. Strangelove, because when you think of General Jack D. Ripper in Dr. Strangelove, well, watch these movies. I'm not saying you should watch these movies back-to-back, because you want to sue me probably on various grounds. But if you were to watch them back-to-back, watch Jack D. Ripper in Dr. Strangelove, and then watch Colonel Stephen J. Lockjaw in this film. And if you were to have a triple feature, now this is really pushing it, if you had a triple feature, you could watch Robert Duvall as Colonel Kilgore in Apocalypse Now. Watch how they walk, watch how they, right? You know what I'm getting at? It's the body language. They trained the same military academy. But I don't want to spoil anything in the story here, but the Sean Penn character, which keeps reminding me of Dr. Strangelove and that general, But that character is so extreme. And, you know, it's hard to talk about the character without spoiling something. But in terms of the values he represents and the things he does and so on, that was one aspect of the film where I thought, well, great performance, but problematic character. Now, I know in real life, and we know from daily newspaper headlines, things take strange turns and things that should be implausible are all too real. I know all that. But watching the film, it just oftentimes struck me as contrivance that he would do certain things. I mean, let me pick your brain on this, because that's actually one of the points where, much as, you know, as a movie nerd, sure, I like making connections with, you know, Dr. Strangelove and Apocalypse Now and the Snap, but that's a parlor game ultimately. As I'm watching the film, this film, there are times where I just wasn't quite buying it at a visceral level. Can I sort of pick your brain on this? Because that's where I didn't entirely turn against the film, but I just found that I was scoffing a bit or not finding it quite as funny as I was meant to find it.
Well, I'll say, like, the Benicio del Toro character kind of gives it another sort of layer, because, you know, he's involved in sheltering or saving immigrants, but he's also a karate teacher. I think that might be what you're referring to. It's like, but why does he have to be a karate teacher? It's just such a weird sort of reason for him to know him.
Well, you know what you're getting at? There's a tossed in or tossed together quality to a film. Like, you know what I'm getting at? It's like, well, okay, it's already veering weird. And I like weird. It's veering weird, but let's make it weirder. So they'll twist things in a way. And in real life, and his character actually, you know, is one of the humane characters. He's very capable when it comes to action and killing and this and that. But he's a humane guy. He's helping the immigrants. He's just a decent guy. He's a good karate teacher, from what I can see. He's got all those things going for him. But the character gets slightly twisted or extended that way. And it's meant to make it somehow richer or funnier. But to me, that's where I see the strings being pulled. It just seems like contrivance to me. There's no reason why in real life you can't be a revolutionary, or at least a fellow traveler to revolutionaries, and also be somebody helping immigrants. And you can actually make very definite thematic connections there, you know, in terms of what he's trying to do and so on. But in the playing and the acting out of it, it to me just sometimes seems like, hey, what if we do this? What if we do that? Let's make him this or that. And that's where, and again, logically, can I prove what I'm saying? No, not really. It's more at gut level. I'm not quite buying it.
There are two scenes that I really, really enjoyed. One is where Leonardo DiCaprio is trying to follow this group of young kids with skateboards who are all running away from the people who were after Leonardo DiCaprio. And he's trying desperately to keep up with them, but he can't, because he's not, you know, 20 anymore. And some of those scenes of him trying to keep up are hilarious until he finally falls off the roof, which is played for a laugh. And yeah, he's trying to get up, and then they stun him. You know?
I like those scenes because they are a reminder of the contemporary quality of the film. This is very much a generational film. What these revolutionaries were up to back in the day, 16 years ago, how they are now. They're generally the worse for wear. It's true. Their ideals have been squashed, but are still there and trying to reconnect. And in case of DiCaprio, his brain is so fried that when he tries to reconnect with some of the revolutionaries, they're playing by the book. Like, well, what's the password before we tell you something you need to know? Password? I don't remember the password. Come on, give me a break here. I'm Bob, and I'll tell you all about. And those are actually, like, really, there's a pathos to scenes like that. They're funny, but also there's a pathos. But that kind of skateboarding stuff, it's parkour. I actually, you know, we'll take the skateboards, like, you know, on the street, on the rooftop, whatever, and bounce around that way. And this is an example of where it works on two counts. One is thematically, it helps to pull the action into the present day and showing, you know, there are younger kids today. You're no longer a kid yourself. And that underscoring works really well thematically. The second reason is technically that Anderson, no big surprise here, is a superb technician in terms of filmmaking. And those scenes are really well shot and edited. I mean, and individual episodes in this film, and it is episodic, really are exciting. I mean, if you watch them on their own, they're really superbly done. That's why when you were mentioning Academy Awards, definitely the actors are all going to be nominated probably. Film itself will definitely has a lock, speaking of lock, on Best Picture nomination, Best Director, all that. But in technical categories, when you get into editing and sound and scoring, for that matter. One thing we haven't talked about yet, there's a lot of scoring in a sexual sense in this film, but scoring in a musical sense. Johnny Greenwood's score is really interesting. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is just simply what I call a jangly solo piano. It can grate on your nerves, but it's meant to. But it's very carefully orchestrated in a really spare way. And I thought, you know, it's far from a conventional musical score, and that's why I liked it so much. It's one reason why the film holds on to that edgy quality. Even when it's starting to lose me, my ears are still very alert to it that way. So, and likewise, in terms of those technical aspects, and of course, this is creative as well in terms of, you know, composing a score, but the sound of the film, the look of it, it was shot in VistaVision. It's a 35 millimeter format, rarely used now. And there are only a few theaters in the country that will show it as it truly should be seen. But it works here because it's an unusually sharp image. So even when the story gets really fuzzy, and it often does, it looks great on the screen. So you and I talk a lot about, and in fact, another friend, and I always talk about this, he and his wife have discussions as in, well, as new movies come out, what should they go to see in a theater on the big screen? What should they wait to see somehow on the small screen or smaller screen at home? This is definitely a movie to see on the biggest screen you can get, because it looks great. Even when it's not great in other ways, it looks great.
There's also another scene that's a car chase on these winding roads. Well, no, they're not winding, they're hilly. So, you know, it's up and down and up and down. And, you know, suddenly it looks like there's nobody on the road. Oh, there's the car again. It really gives you a sense of impending tension.
Can I make a car connection here? Another film that was shot in VistaVision was Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo. And when you think about car scenes in a film like that, these directors know what they're doing there, because you really get the panorama, the urban panorama or rural, doesn't matter really. You get a sense of the car moving through space, you know. And so if it's a car chase or even just a car going down the street, you're like the most alert passenger in the car at that point. You're sharing the POV of the driver, but you're also looking out, you know, what's alongside the road, this and that. It keeps you fully awake. Like you don't want to be distracted by anything else. You shouldn't like go out for popcorn or anything. You want to stay and see what's around the corner. And you know, any film can do that. But the one thing about VistaVision is it really gets you pulled into that visual world. And, you know, don't you sense that, like, with one of the many great things about Vertigo is how you totally get pulled into it. It's immersive that way. And this film, for better or for worse, is immersive. It doesn't work for me oftentimes, but I can't deny it. You know, I'm pulled into this world, and I know a few hours later I'll be released.
Well, in terms of how well you think this is going to do at the box office, do you think this is a winner?
Well, you know, I usually shy away from questions like that because I'm wrong, you know, and I don't want to be wrong again. But, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson's been a critical favorite for many years now. And you made a really good observation to kick us off here that, you know, a critical darling and movie buffs love him and so on. The films haven't always done as well at the box office, but they've done okay. You know what I mean? Like it's not like he's only riding on critical laurels. I mean, he's got a box office following. It's not typically, you know, as big as some of the you know, superhero type movies, but his films are challenging. I mean, it's, if you're looking for like light entertainment on a Saturday night, you should definitely pick something else, you know. but you also made the very good point that in terms of theatrical box office, but I would say beyond that, in terms of streaming and just however people watch movies now, the casting certainly helps here. Leonardo DiCaprio can carry a film, goes without saying. The critical kudos extended to Sean Penn and so on. Yeah, people are going to know those names. And yeah, that can only help in that respect. So I hope the film does really well, because I mean, it's so much better than most of the films I see. So that's why even though mine's a Minority Report, at least there's a lot I can say in favor of this film that really is exciting. So many other films, you know, they might be somehow more satisfying, but, you know, by the next week, I've forgotten them already, right? This is a film I remember.
I think this is a movie people are going to go see because people are talking about it.
And I'm going to say one final observation, just by way of how clever it is in so many ways. And as movie nerds, we should mention this. Here you have I love the way you describe Leonardo DiCaprio's character. He's really gone to pot. He's really a mess. He looks horrible. And how many actors would have that much confidence in themselves to just let themselves go? I mean, when he walks down the hallway in a bathroom, it's like, oh, please, you almost want to look away. You know, life has not been kind to him in middle age. But just because he's hanging out and just passing the time, when he's not, you know, ingesting various substances and just looking out the window, he watches Guillo Pontecorvo's Battle of Algiers from 1966, one of the all-time great movies, if I can give it a plug, but one of the very greatest films ever about revolution. I mean, it's just an exceptional film. It's a masterpiece. And the fact that in his middle-aged dotage, he would sit watching that, it's both funny and really heartbreaking. I mean, he's thinking back to revolutionary fervor and the idealism of that period. And that movie is very much about the Algerians fighting for their their independence from France to no longer be a French colony. So it's really very much a late 50s, early 60s kind of scenario. But this is a film that constantly in the present looks to the past. And I thought that was an incredibly smart thing for Paul Thomas Anderson to call our attention to. So it's not just the movie nerd, you know, giving himself points for recognizing the clip. It's not just that. It's that even if you don't quite recognize the clip, you essentially get the context, don't you? You get him watching old black and white movies and connecting that way. And, you know, we can even go back to Casablanca as we did with The Drink before.
Well, let's move on to our second movie, which is A Big, Bold, Beautiful Journey. Now, I'm going to start off by saying that I am the viewer for this kind of a movie. I love rom-coms. I love both of these actors, Colin Farrell and Margot Robbie. And I like whimsy. But this movie was a clunker. And I have to say, it's got some beautiful, beautiful scenes. You could just take a still and make a postcard out of it. I loved the references to Jacques Demy. I felt a little bit like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, but it just didn't. The central conceit that the GPS in your rental car is going to take you into the past where you're going to deal with various things that happened, it just didn't work for me. I mean, I just couldn't suspend the disbelief to get there. How about you, Mike?
I'll follow in your wake and say the film is a total failure. I'll cut to the chase on this. It's directed by Coganada, but it wants to be a Charlie Kaufman movie. That's what it wants. And this is a tricky thing. It's dealing in magical realism, which unless you hit it right, can be, as you say, clunker is a good word to use here. Just to set the stage, so we don't want people to watch this movie. We want to talk about it so you don't watch it. But if you have the misfortune of watching it, there are characters, Sarah and David, played by Margot Robbie and Colin Farrell. They meet cute at the wedding of mutual friends. And then what happens, and this is the leap into magical realism, they discover that doors serve as portals to the past. So if they're, particularly if they're walking, like, they shouldn't go for walks in the woods, because these, well, for some reason, when you walk in the woods, it leads you up to door frame. And when you go through the door frame, it takes you into the past. And don't ask me to explain that further, because the film sure doesn't. It's just, that's a given, right? And you go with that or you don't. And I wasn't going with it particularly. But, you know, if you were to go with that conceit, it's potentially interesting. You meet somebody, you get to know them, and then somehow through some magic hocus pocus, it carries you to the past where, you know, and again, you're going from past to present constantly in a film like this. Here's the real problem in the film. It's with the script. You mentioned visually how there's some striking scenes. Yeah, I'll go along with that. It you know, eye candy kind of appeal that way. But where it really fails is with the script, because both characters are so superficially written. They're so shallow that as they're like, oh, wow, man, that was, my, you know, they go at those conversations. I don't know them very well. I don't care about them at all. I mean, it sounds cold hearted, but I really don't. So whatever revelations are meant to be there and whatever bonding between them, the film left me not just cool, but totally cold. I was so indifferent to it after a while. I wanted to find the portal that would get me out of the theater. You know, that's what that's what I wanted. And the film has had mostly bad reviews, as it should. And one, I think one indication of the failure of it is that the film is so heavy-handed in its treatment of the superficiality. And it starts with the film's very title. Whenever you and I talk about this film, we have to like double check ourselves. Did we get the title right? A Big, Bold, Beautiful Journey. Well, gosh, that's what it's going to be. You know, why not put some more adjectives in there and just pile them on? doesn't it have that quality? That I just want to like truncate it and say, well, yeah, I guess it's big. Is it bold? I guess it's bold. Is it beautiful? Yeah, and sometimes it is. Is it a journey? Oh boy, is it. So I just think it's kind of shameless that way. And I think it'll be quickly forgotten, really, because it's not a film that has gotten good reviews or done well. And it's a misfire, you know, and I don't want to seem sadistic and like, you know, twist the knife that way. But there's almost nothing good to say about this film.
Well, I will say I completely agree with you. The problem is the script, because one thing I was thinking while I was watching it was, you know what, if they just turned off the sound and I could make up what was going on and what they were saying, it would have been a much better movie, because it's like I said, it's certain scenes are gorgeous and, you know, you couldn't have two prettier people playing the leads. But there's no chemistry. They say things people that they just don't say. It was just most of it. I was just, you know, shaking my head going, oh, come on. Now, apparently the GPS system in the original script was supposed to actually be sentient. so would actually, you know what was going on with you and that kind of thing, which I think would have been a better movie. But almost anything could have been done to make this a better movie.
One of my logical reservations, and once you start having logical reservations here, it's all over, right? But okay, so they're in the car and the GPS is going to like say, well, turn right here. Now, most drivers are very obedient. They follow their GPS. They don't dare disobey it. But I've occasionally, you know, Uber rides, things like that. Occasionally, like the GPS is saying turn right. And I'm saying, no, you're actually better off turning left. Because it's like, you know, like I know the roads, right? So Turn this way, not that. But the driver sometimes is like, well, no, the GPS is saying. So that's our God. We're accustomed to obeying the GPS always. But the thing is, like, once they know how this metaphysical deal works, why do they keep going along with it all the time? It's just like, well, maybe don't get in the car, or get in the car, but disobey the GPS. I mean, is it that total a lock that you have to like do everything that it tells you to do? And they're so unthinking that way. And the unthinking quality extends, as you say, to the dialogue. It's really trite. It's really cliche. It has a really forced quasi-literate quality to it, you know, that is, and people usually don't talk quite this way, but they are because they're movie characters and they talk back and forth this way. It's just not very interesting, and it's just not very believable even. You realize that they're living in a conceit. They're operating in this sort of conceit of these two characters are supposed to love each other. There is absolutely zero chemistry between two very attractive actors, right? Now that's a feat. You get two really beautiful people and you don't feel any chemistry here. That's an interesting study. What went wrong that there's no chemistry at all? You know, I found myself more enamored of the doorways, like architecturally. What kind of door is this?
Actually, I think there was some meaning to the colors. So the pale yellow is regret, ultramarine for denial, and blood red for acceptance. So not that I recommend you go back and rewatch it to pick that up. But just for
if you're painting your house and you want some color guides, some keys, I guess so. But and I like movies typically that are color coded in a way. I like that sometimes the cleverness of how they work certain colors in. Here it's just like it's one of those well whatever responses I have. You know, if they say, well, here's the yellow, here's the pencil. Well, so what? You know, I mean, I just, you know, get rid of all those colors and just let them turn left rather than right. You know, let them have a normal relationship and maybe I'll care about them. But here they are totally subject to and prisoner of the script that they've been given, you know? And that's why you can sense this in the acting, actually. And I know I'm being kind of mean-spirited here, but it's as if these actors have their lines and my line, your line. It's that kind of a thing. And I'm facing you on a screen right now and I'm speaking to you in a certain way. And there might not be any genuine feeling there, but I got my line out, didn't I? I said the line of dialogue. It's failing at that basic level of they know their lines, but there's nothing behind the lines, really.
Yes, there is a scene where they're in this diner and they're eating cheeseburgers and she takes one of his onion rings. And they've been talking about how, you know, they're not right for each other for various reasons. She takes the onion ring and she says, "This is the only ring I'm ever going to get from you." And it you know, it was supposed to be funny, but it was just boring. It was boring, which is the worst thing you can do.
Yeah, so it's one of the worst movies of the year, and we're endorsing Onion Rings, but not this onion of a movie.
Not this one. This onion of a movie. Okay, that does bring us to the end of the show. But don't forget to check out our other episodes at atmhcc.podbean.com. And we'll see you next time at the movies.
See you then.
Thanks for listening to Dragon Podcasts. Connect with us at podbean.com/dragonpodcasts.